ओम गणचमिनंदस्य जनाजना सुलकाय चक्षुस्मिलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनुभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदमयं ददति सापदन्तिकम् पञ्चकपृथिव्यश्च कृपसिन्धुभैरुभ्यश्च पतितरं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. Please tell me what you remember from yesterday's class, or something, a point from yesterday's class. Who was in yesterday's class? Okay, that's quite a lot of the devotees. Who remembers something?
Krishna is Satya in all regards.
Yes. Thank you. Very important verse. That verse, which is the 26th verse of the second chapter of the prayers of the demigods. How many times is the word satya used in that verse?
Six times.
And Srila Jiva Goswami points to this verse to indicate that the first verse of the Bhagavatam, satyam param dhimahi, which evokes remembrance and a meditation upon the satyam, the truth, the absolute truth, that it specifically refers to Krishna. That satyam param dhimahi specifically refers to Krishna, the absolute truth is Krishna. Now what is astounding about that, that the absolute truth is Krishna? None of you are astounded. But what is astounding about that?
One person we can trust.
You mean it's astounding that there's one person that we can actually trust? But what is most astounding, even more astounding than that? What does absolute truth mean? What is it? What is your understanding of what the absolute? What does it mean?
Totalizes everything.
Yeah, all inclusive. That reality, the total of reality plus more. Yeah. What else? All inclusive.
Never changes.
Yeah, it can't change, but yet somehow ever increasing. Yes, but that's just a little part of what the absolute truth is. Yes, definitely. All the relative truths rest upon him. That's what you wanted to say. They are based upon him. Everything in existence, everything in non-existence rests upon this absolute truth. Now what's astounding about this, because this is the all-inclusive reality. There's nothing external to him. Not only all-powerful, not only the Creator, not only the Supreme Enjoyer, not only possessing all fame and Sadaishwarya Purnam, not only that, but unlimitedly. Oh yes, everyone should turn off their mobile phones. We should put a sign outside the door. Turn off your mobile phones, no bombs, guns, etc., metal detectors, but at least turn off the mobile phone. Especially Nokia rings. What is the astounding thing about this absolute truth? Yes, from that point of view, certainly that's, he's all-powerful in the absolute truth, yet he comes under the control of his devotees. But his, if you're looking at it from the point of view of the tattva of the absolute truth, then the devotees are not external to him. So he's not coming under the control of anything external to him. So that will be less astounding if you look at it from that point of view. What's astounding about this absolute truth? Come on! Just look where we are in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. The demigods are praying, To who? To the absolute truth. And where is this absolute truth? He's in the womb. And this chapter in Sanskrit is called Garbha Stuti, the prayers to the womb. The absolute truth, which nothing is external to, is within Devaki. That supreme absolute truth, Krishna, is within the womb of Devaki. And not only that, but this absolute truth is going to do the most astounding things from the point of view of what one would expect God, the Param Ishwara, the Supreme Controller, to do. He's going to wander around the fields of Vrindavan herding cows like a cowherd boy, not even like a Kshatriya or a Brahmin. He's going to wander around Vrindavan with his hand on the hump of a Sarabi cow and carrying a flute in his belt and a peacock feather that he's picked up from the ground or his cowherd boyfriends have given to him. He's placing it in his, and he's going to wander around without shoes because he's a cowherd boy. Now this is impossible, not only astounding, but from the material point of view, this is impossible to conceive of. So Lord Brahma and the other great exalted personalities, the devas, they're going to pray to the Lord who is within the womb of Devaki. And we should listen to their prayers because they're going to bring up this point, not from the point of this is the most astounding thing, but that this absolute truth is within the womb of Devaki. And we who are hearing the Bhagavatam in the second chapter, who are going to go on, Krishna willing, to the third chapter, the fourth chapter, the fifth chapter, and onward, even up to the 33rd chapter of the 10th canto and the rasa dance, the dancing of the absolute truth, the supreme personality of Godhead, dancing with young married ladies married to someone else in the middle of the night, the absolute truth, the supreme God. And we're going to worship this activity of his, which from the material point of view must be considered completely immoral. And we're going to worship that activity as the topmost exchange of the absolute truth with his devotees. So because of this point that he acts in such astounding ways, not astounding from the point of view of ordinary people, meaning that this is what ordinary people might do. There are so many cowherd boys. There are so many people who dance with the wives of others in the middle of the night. But from the point of view of the most worshipable, the Lord of our life, and we're going to take complete shelter of him, and we're going to, even more than take shelter of him, fall in love with him. That's what we want to do. Prema Pamarto Mahan. This is what we want to do. So we better hear it again and again and again that these activities that he's going to perform, although they superficially, on the surface, appear to be ordinary activities, ordinary meaning the activities of that ordinary persons can perform, yet when he performs them, they are the most extraordinary activities. So we have to be reminded again and again of the extraordinary nature of this person who is going to be performing these seemingly simple human activities, but because it's he who is doing them, they are not simple. They are the most, this is Ladini Shakrishna's dealing with his devotees are all simply interplays of the internal energy, his internal energy. So this truth, or the fact, or the reality that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Krishna, and he has a form. Not only a form, he has an inconceivably powerful form that's all beautiful, unlimitedly beautiful. I liked this point personally, that Krishna is unlimitedly beautiful. Just meditate on this for a moment, that his beauty has no limit. That which attracts us, the beauty that attracts us in this world, take that and multiply it by 1,000, then 1,000,000, then 1,000,000,000, and then 1,000,000,000,000, and then another 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, doesn't approach what unlimited means, that he has unlimited beauty, ever expanding, all attractive, unlimited beauty and unlimited power, strength. What does that even mean? To create a universe, nothing for him. To create 10 universes, nothing for him. To create 1,000 or 1,000,000 universes or 1,000,000,000 universes or 1,000,000,000,000 universes doesn't deplete, diminish his power in the slightest bit, because he's unlimitedly powerful. And this is who we're dealing with in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. And therefore, this 10th canto is the most important canto, in that all the cantos lead up to this 10th canto are preparing us to hear about Krishna and his activities. There are so many ways we can examine and study the transcendental pastimes of Krishna as he wanders through the fields of Vrindavan, or as he engages in diplomacy in Dwarka or somewhere. We can look at it from the philosophical point of view. We can look at it from the point of view of metaphor, and there are many incredible metaphors hidden within these pastimes. And we can look at it from the point of view of Leela, and the highest, or Leela, what does Leela mean? Pastimes or play. This is the play or activities, and this Leela point of view of just simply the Krishna engaging in playful pastimes with his most intimate beloved devotees. This is the highest point of view. This is the most wonderful point of view, but we have to approach it with a straw between our teeth, very, very humbly, and take these wonderful pastimes as they are given and hear. And we'll see as we go through this 10th canto, there'll be a pastime, then there'll be some prayers, and then Krishna will display some of his Aishwarya, some of his unlimited potency, a small amount of his unlimited potency. Come closer. Because we can't forget who this person performing the activities is. We can't forget that, because otherwise we'll think that this is ordinary, and then we will have missed everything. We may become great scholars, we may become many things, but we won't become lovers of Krishna, because the only way, bhakti mam abhijananti yavanyas jasmi tatvata. Prabhupada will quote this later, that only if we develop bhakti, love for Krishna, will we actually be able to enter into the mysteries, very mysterious pastimes of Krishna. We actually have to become devotees, bhaktis. Or bhakta, bhakta jana priya, or devotees of devotees. So that 26th verse, the first of the prayers of the demigods, begins saying that Krishna is the absolute truth. Satyam, satyam, he's the absolute truth. He's absolute, he's truth in so many different ways. Then in the second verse, there is another mysterious verse comparing the bodies of the living entities and also the total universal body to a tree, with quite a few analogies within it. So then the question comes, that where does this tree come from? Where does the universe come from? Where does our body come from? Where do we come from? So in this 28th verse, the demigods, these very powerful, very learned, subtle beings who exist within this world. Has anyone seen demigods here? Has anyone? No one will admit to it. But yet these subtle beings, these subtle planes of existence are there. And these persons have a greater perspective on reality than we do. So we are expected to hear their perspective, accepting that their perspective is greater than ours, just like a person in the third grade of school listens to the perspective of learning and knowledge from the teachers, because the teachers are expected, and they must have a fuller perspective, more knowledge than the students. So therefore, by the students listening to the teachers, by humans such as ourselves, aspiring humans, by hearing the perspective of the demigods, our perspective of reality is to increase, and specifically they're going to speak about Krishna, the absolute truth, who they're offering their prayers to, whom this tree, the material existence, goes within at the time of annihilation. The entire material existence comes from him, including each and every one of us. It comes from him. That absolute truth, that param satyam. And it is maintained, the material existence is maintained by the absolute truth. Everything is rest, every single thing. That is the meaning of the absolute truth, that there is nothing that doesn't rest, depend, or is included within him. Different, as Prabhupada explains right in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, perhaps in the first purport to the first verse, there is nothing. There's a difference between the concept of God and the concept of the absolute truth. The absolute truth is all-inclusive, including everything. Nothing is external. The concept of God simply means the Ishwara, the control of the Paramishwara. So this absolute truth that everything is resting upon cannot be seen. Those who are in Maya, those who Maya Javani Katsanam, the curtain of Maya has descended over their eyes. They cannot see that it is all resting upon him, this absolute truth, who is within the womb of Devaki, quite astoundingly, because he's within something that he is also external to, outside of, and it is also within him. He is within something that is within him. This is Krishna's inconceivable Shakti. And this is something that we just simply have to accept, that the practically the definition, or one of the fundamental principles of the Absolute Truth is that he has inconceivable shakti, that he is Swatantra. He is capable of doing anything as Satya Sankalpa. What he desires is what occurs. He can bend the laws of material nature. He can break them. He can establish them. He can transcend them. He can be smaller than them. He can become greater than them. He is the one who is independent. And there he is, astoundingly, within the womb of Devaki. And those whose vision is covered by the illusory energy, the external energy, Maya Devani Katsanam, they cannot perceive him anywhere, Anta Bahira Vastitam, although he is everywhere. Due to Maya, we cannot perceive him anywhere. So that is also astounding. He is everywhere, but we don't see him anywhere. So that's what they say in the 28th verse, the demigods. Those who are covered by the external energy cannot see you behind this material manifestation. But their vision is not the vision of learned devotees, and the demigods are learned devotees. O Lord, this is in the 29th verse. So there he is within the womb, and he's the absolute truth upon whom everything rests, and there he is within the womb of Devaki. Now why? We can say, what in the world is he doing there? But actually he is not in the world at all. And it is not that he has descended to this world either, because he doesn't descend. He never loses his reality. He doesn't descend into the material world as if he becomes part of the material world. He's never in the material world. Krishna cannot be in the material world, or when he's in the material world isn't a material world from his point of view. Like the king, when he's in the prison, he's not in prison. It's just another department for him. So this tattva, these tattvas about the absolute truth about Krishna being described by the demigods. And when you come as an incarnation, which is also not a proper word, actually, but there is no word in English that describes what Krishna does when he comes. He is avatar, but he's not incarnation. He's not in flesh. He's not incarnate. He's not within flesh at all. His body is composed of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. Try to think about that. His body is completely spiritual. It is not of this world at all. Think about that. And there he is, and the demigods want to describe his position again so that when we see his transcendental pastimes, we will not become confused thinking that because they are Naralila or human-like pastimes that they are that Krishna is a human performing human activities. No, his body is completely transcendental. So you appear in different incarnations that are all beyond transcendental to the material creation. What does that mean? They are transcendental to the material creation. We use that word transcendental so much that we don't even know what it means even more anymore. Simple word. What does it mean?
It doesn't touch the material.
Yeah, has nothing to do beyond the material energy. So because our experience only is of the material energy, how are we going to conceive of something, someone who is beyond the material energy? And this is the problem. And therefore we have to hear from a different perspective. This is the essential spiritual problem. We are in the material world. At least I could speak for myself. My conceptions are of the material world. My mind is of the material world. The vehicle that I use, the intelligence, the ears, the tongue, they're all of material. How can these material things perceive the transcendental beyond them, beyond their capacity? Indeed, they cannot by their own power. But by hearing from this transcendental platform, then despite the materialness of the vehicle, of the ear, because after all it's composed of matter, still it has a transcendental effect. This is a wonder of spiritual life, because this transcendental sound vibration comes from the spiritual world, Golo, Keda, Prema, Dana. So Krishna appears in these incarnations, and his appearance means death for the wicked materialist asuras and transcendental enlivenment to the spiritualists. And if one, text 30, concentrates his meditation on Krishna's lotus feet by this process, these two verses, 30 and 31, are very important. If one learns the art, and it sounds easier than it is, if one learns the art of meditating upon the lotus feet, following the path of the great acharyas, one can what? Cross the material ocean to the other side. And what is on the other side of the material ocean? Yes, and depending upon what one wants in the spiritual world, what one's desires are, what mercy he wants and has gotten, then he can go to a different place. But what is the meaning? Why is the material world, the material existence, compared to an ocean? Why is it compared to an ocean? The ocean, Baba Sindhu, why is it compared to an ocean?
Unfathomably vast and stormy.
And no matter how good a swimmer you are, no matter how intelligent, no matter how materially qualified one is, one simply cannot cross the ocean by his own power, by his swimming power. But by this process, the process given by the acharyas, by the process of somehow or another keeping oneself in remembrance of Krishna, in other words, keeping oneself absorbed in transcendence, because remembrance of Krishna and Krishna are the same, then one can cross over this uncrossable ocean. Now, what is the benefit of crossing over the material ocean? This, we should also remind ourselves of this obvious point. But why should we? Why is it important to keep remembering why it's important to cross over the material ocean? We'll start with that one. But why is it important to keep remembering that it's important to cross over the material ocean? Just think, don't just give answers. But why is it important? Yeah, but why is it important to keep remembering the importance of crossing the ocean of...
Otherwise we will have no impetus to resist kama, krodha, lobha, the obstacles to that.
It's so bewildering on minute-to-minute basis that we have the tendency to forget again.
That's what I was thinking, that we just have a tendency to forget, and we think that tomorrow is just going to be like today and yesterday. and the next day will be the same, and we'll just keep on gliding along in the ocean and enjoying life in some way or another, and talking with our friends and doing the things we like to do. And then one day, you know what's going to happen? We're going to go to the doctor for a checkup, and he's going to say, he'll put on that very doctorly expression on his face, which mixes compassion with seriousness, and he'll say, "Please sit down. I've examined your tests, and you have 20 seconds to live," or something like that. Or we'll get hit by a truck or a train or a... It's going to happen. It's going to happen. There's not many things in this world that I can say with surety, perhaps, but this one I can say, that we're all going to die. Yes. Even though it doesn't feel like it right now, unless you happen to be in a situation where it really hurts in many, many places all at once. But it doesn't feel like it, because it's the nature of the soul to not die. So in that sense, it's true, we don't die. But this, we are going to sink within the ocean of material existence. This body, which we think of as ourself, this tree, with its branches and roots and flowers and hollows, is going to have a crash landing. It must sink into the ocean and dissolve. And it's important to remember this, because otherwise we don't have an impetus to cross. We just think, oh, it's so nice here, it's so much fun, the flowers are nice and the weather is nice, and if the weather isn't nice, turn on the heater or the air conditioner, and this problem may be there, but still. And that is Maya's business, to make us think in that way, to hide the truth that it's a very dangerous place. So therefore, it's important that we make note and keep in our consciousness that our life will not last forever in this material body, and make proper use of our time to cross over this unfathomable ocean. So how can we cross over something that we can't cross over? We can cross over it by grace, by mercy, by the help of Krishna in the form of meditating upon him and the following the processes of the great acharyas. The fierce ocean of nescience, the acharyas leave behind their methodology. Now the verse where we get up to, that we begin today's classes. Very famous verse. Yenye arvindaksha vamuktamaninas tvayastabhavalabhasudzabudaya aruha kvitsrena parampadam tata patantyado andrita yuzma langraya. Anyone, O lotus-eyed one, vamuktimanina, falsely considering themselves free from the bondage of material contamination, as Prabhupada translates this often, that a person who doesn't take to devotional service, but thinks that he's free from the material energy without having the shelter of Bhakti Devi, they are vamuktimaninas. Their liberation is just in their mind. They're imagining it like, I'm imagining I'm a millionaire or a billionaire. I can imagine it and I can walk around thinking I'm a millionaire or a billionaire, but reality is I can't buy anything that a millionaire or a billionaire can purchase. So similarly, a person who is liberated considering himself liberated just by some other process other than bhakti, that it's just their imagination, vimukti maninas. Their liberation is just what they're thinking they're liberated. It's not any more valuable or any closer to being actually liberated than a person who is thinking himself a pauper, who is thinking himself a billionaire. There's no more value or wealth attached to him than that. And what process are these kind of people using? Twayi astabhavad avishuddha buddhaya. Their intelligence is avishuddha. Shuddha and avishuddha. They have impure intelligence and they're just using that impure intelligence to try to reach the absolute truth. It's like catching the hole of the tail of a dog and trying to cross the ocean, the insurmountable ocean, by that mythology. So a ruha kutsthena, even though they may, by their austerities, perform very severe austerities, detaching the senses from the sense objects and performing penances and so many difficult things, they may even achieve, they may even somewhat in their sadhana stage go into this impersonal liberation, become liberated in that way. But padam, tata, from that position, pantyat, they fall down, ada, again into the material existence, andrita, yuzmar, angrahai, because of this one point, they have neglected your lotus feet, O Lord, who is within the womb of Devaki. So this answers the question as Prabhupada places at the beginning of his translation here. Someone may say that aside from the devotees who always seek shelter at the Lord's lotus feet, there are those who are not devotees, but who accept different processes for attaining, have accepted different processes for crossing the ocean, for attaining salvation. What happens to them? They don't meditate on Krishna. They are not devotees. Does that mean that they don't actually cross the ocean of material existence? What happens to them? Even though they're so renounced, they're powerful, they're pure. Pure means there is no impurity. But as the demigods are saying, actually they're not impure. They're avishuddha buddhaya, their intelligence, their conceptual ability is impure. And the impure cannot reach the pure. By the power of the impure, cannot get the pure. So in answer to this question, Lord Brahma and the other demigods said, O lotus-eyed Lord, although non-devotees who accept severe austerities and penances to achieve the highest position may think themselves limited, liberated. What is the Sanskrit word that means they're thinking themselves? Vimuktamaninas. They think themselves liberated by their austerities and penances and living aloof from society and detaching themselves and separating the senses from the sense objects. They think themselves liberated, but because their intelligence is impure, they have a misconception about their own position because there is no safe shelter, or there is no shelter. They have not actually achieved shelter because they have not taken shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. And therefore they fall down from their position of imagined superiority because they have no regard for your lotus feet. They have turned their back on Krishna. They take shelter of the impersonal, the effulgence of Krishna, the Brahman. But they don't have Krishna's shelter, and therefore their position is precarious. Or, even worse than them falling down, is what? Them succeeding in merging. Because then they are lost, spiritual suicide. So the fact that they don't have a secure shelter is great mercy on them. Because then they have hope, even though they don't see it like that. They can't see it like that. They falsely think they have been liberated. What I would like to do is, I won't promise quickly, but I'd like to go over the whole string of verses here, and then we'll go back and read Prabhupada's point, just so we get a feel for the prayers, the arguments, so to speak, the points put forward by the demigods. Because again, this is what Krishna looks like from the point of view of the demigods. Now there's many prayers in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, throughout the Bhagavatam. Sometimes Dhruva Maharaj offered prayers, Prahlad offered prayers, so many demigods offered prayers, Indra, Brahma, Lord Shiva offered prayers. So everyone offers prayers according to their own consciousness. So, because no one can perfectly and completely conceive of the absolute truth of Krishna, so anyone can appreciate him only from their own individual point of view. So this is the point of appreciation from the demigods, which is very important for us to understand, because they're universal creators. So they have a universal understanding of the absolute truth of Krishna. So we'll read the verses and see what they're saying, then we'll hear Prabhupada's comments. O Madhava, this is 33, Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, that's Madhava, the meaning of Madhava. If devotees completely in love with you sometimes fall from the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you still protect them. So there's comparison going on between the position of the non-devotees, even if they're transcendentalists, even if they are pure and almost practically achieve liberation, they fall down, but their falling down is different from when devotees falling down, because they have a relationship with Krishna. Krishna protects them. Kaunteya pratijanihi. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. Even if there is difficulty, there is the effect of Krishna's mercy, Krishna's personal care for the devotees. If we don't trust that, then what hope will we have? If we don't have experience and trust of that, it's that Krishna, despite my lack in devotion and service and maturity, that Krishna is still there, like the small children, babies, 1 year olds, who are just learning to walk, and they're trying to hold on to their parents, their mother, their father's hands, and sometimes they just, boom, they fall down. But then the parents are right there. As long as if they hold on, it's so much easier. But if they don't, the parents will pick them up. Come on, keep trying, keep trying. It feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? Sometimes we also squeak and squeal. So they continue in 34. So this is Krishna. This is Krishna consciousness. That ultimately it's a dependence on Krishna's mercy. We try, but we depend on Krishna's mercy. And therefore, the trust of the devotee is not in his own capacity, but it is in Krishna's causeless mercy. And if one actually trusts Krishna's causeless mercy, then what happens? Well, we'll perform a scientific experiment right now. If everyone would just for a moment think just for the sake of science, think that actually Krishna is not only there, but despite everything, he cares for me and he's protecting me right now, and that he's going to, either slowly or quickly, depending upon his desire and perhaps somewhat my capacity, that we're actually in his hands and he's actually caring for us and is bringing us, in the process of bringing us home right now, even right now. I mean, if we seriously consider this, trust that we are in Krishna's hands right now, not only right now, but tomorrow and the next day, and because the relationship is established by his causeless mercy. Now, how do you feel? Yes?
Peaceful and satisfied.
How do you feel?
Grateful. I feel relieved because it's not dependent on my own power.
Yeah. When we're young, we like to depend on our power, our abilities. But as we get older, we're quite grateful that Krishna... But if we can learn this when we're young, save us a lot of difficulty in life. That's why Krishna so kindly pulls out the carpet every now and then and causes us to land on our nose or our heads every now and then, so that we become more humble and more dependent and realize our own limitations. So, this is good science, isn't it? So, the devotees, because even though they may have difficulties, it's not that I'm a devotee, you know, I don't do anything wrong. Krishna's taking care of me. I can do whatever I want. That's not certainly the mood of a devotee. That's the mood of a non-devotee, actually, or the non-devotional parts of us. A devotee tries to please Krishna. That's what it means to be a devotee. So he's going to act properly as best he can. But even if there is some difficulty, he knows that Krishna is going to protect him. So, because of his humility, and he's willing to take the reactions for the improprieties of his activities, but he just wants his business, his mission is to hold tightly to Krishna's service in all circumstances and remember Krishna. And Krishna takes care of the devotee. So the devotee wants to simply hold on tightly, carefully not let go. That's the prayer of the devotee. And because he knows he's weak, and he knows that the material energy is very strong, he has experience, he knows how precarious one's position is in the material world. He acts very carefully in this world and does not play with fire, the fire of Maya, because he knows that if he plays with fire, he will get burnt. Raise your hand if you've ever been seriously burnt. Was it fun?
No.
What does it feel like?
Pain.
Huh?
Painful.
I want more description in this, just so we become a little terror enters our hearts. What does it feel like?
It's like you don't want to live anymore. Like what?
Don't want to live anymore. But your whole, it just burns. A burn means that you feel burning sensation. Your life is burning. That's what sometimes the great acharyas compare the material experience. Samsara bishanale. Diva nishi here jale, I'm burning in the fire of material existence. Samsara dava nalalita loka. This material world is like a forest fire, and we're going to enjoy ourselves in a forest, in the middle of a forest fire. We're surrounded and we're burning and we're going to have a good time. No wonder people take shelter of intoxication, because they don't want to see reality, the forest fire of the material world. But the devotees will be cared for. But they're careful. That was the point. They know the nature of the material world, so they act carefully and they try with whatever power and sincerity they have not to, to take shelter of Krishna, to remember him always, and keep themselves engaged in his service as servants. So now the demigods continue. O Lord. So they've just explained differences between devotees and non-devotees. And here, during the time of maintenance of the universe, you manifest several incarnations, all with transcendental bodies, beyond the material modes of nature. When you appear in this way, you bestow all good fortune upon the living entities by teaching them to perform Vedic activities, such as ritualistic ceremonies, mystic yoga, austerities, penance, and ultimately samadhi, ecstatic absorption in thoughts of you. Thus you are worshipped by the Vedic principles. So when the incarnations, Krishna comes into this material world to bestow his kindness on everyone, and he teaches principles that elevate individuals spiritually, even though there are different levels of elevation, and some of the levels of elevation are just more materially pious and materially better. But ultimately, the purpose of the Vedas, even the Karmakanda section, everything worships Krishna. This is the goal. So this is what they're saying. And you come in different incarnations. You come in different incarnations. And all the Vedic principles just actually are worshiping you. And remember that these prayers are spoken to him who's in the womb. He's not even born yet. He hasn't come out and started to play yet. O Lord, this is 35, cause of all causes, if your transcendental body were not beyond the modes of material nature, one could not understand the difference between matter and transcendence. Only by your presence can one understand the transcendental nature of your lordship. I'm going to ask you what your understanding of this is. I'll read it again so that you listen. O Lord, cause of all causes, if your transcendental body were not beyond the modes of material nature, one could not understand the difference between matter and transcendence. Why? Only by your presence can one understand the transcendental nature of your lordship, who are the controller of material nature. Your transcendental nature is very difficult to understand unless one is influenced by the presence of your transcendental form. What does that mean? But more than that, or maybe less than that, is this point, that we would have, unless we were somehow in touch with transcendence, we would have no conception of what transcendence is. If all we knew was darkness, we would have no conception of what light is. If all you know is sweets, you don't have any conception of salt, salty foods. So we have, everyone in the material world is on a diet of matter. And we have no conception, not the devotees over here, but we have no conception of what spirit is, or spiritual life is, or what Vrindavan is, or what deities are, or the holy name, or a transcendental book. We just don't have a conception or devotional service, and this is where it's really true, because a materialistic person will see the devotional activities of a devotee and think that they're material, because this is his only conception, is material, is matter. So he thinks, yes, this is material, because this is what I do. They're doing this, they're doing that. But actually, there's a complete difference between the name of Krishna and the name of a mundane thing. There's a complete difference between Krishna Balaram, Radhasyama Sundar, and a statue. And a materialist, no matter how intelligent they are, unless they have a spiritual conception placed in their consciousness, they simply can't conceive of it. So unless one has an understanding specifically of spiritual form, which is what this is referring to, your transcendental body, of spiritual personhood, one will think that Krishna is material and the absolute truth is formless. The negation of material form, they will think, is formlessness, impersonalism. So therefore, this is being explained, that there has to be, that the transcendental nature is very difficult to understand. It's very difficult to understand, as we're saying, that the Supreme Absolute Truth is a person. Your transcendental form, your transcendental nature, your transcendental activities, your transcendental characteristics that are all personal, unless one has a spiritual perspective, one will mistake these to be material and be an impersonalist, thinking that the absence of material is formlessness. That there's no content in spiritual life. So again, it is not by accident that the demigods are speaking these prayers, because we're going to be hearing very intimate activities of the Absolute Truth, like the king, his most intimate activities in his private palace, something like that. We're going to be visiting Vrindavan. The Bhagavatam is going to take us by the hand and bring us to Vrindavan. And we have to get this point very clear in our consciousness, otherwise we will mistake Krishna's activities for material activities. Unless one is influenced by the presence of your transcendental form. And to be in the presence of Krishna's transcendental form, even if there is a covering of our eyes to some degree, Krishna's transcendental form is so powerful, it will influence us despite the covering of our eyes. And if we have just a little fortune in our consciousness, we will be influenced by the transcendental potency of Krishna's form, of Krishna's Dham, of Krishna's holy names. There are so many countless examples of this. And people don't even know what's happening to them, this agyata sukriti, unknowing spiritual piety, not consciously performed spiritual piety, but spiritual piety that just happens to one by the blessings of from above. So many examples of this. Materialists, complete atheists, come to a holy place like Vrindavan, and with just a little bit of association, something shifts within their consciousness. Materialists, atheists, fanatics hear Hare Krishna chanted every day, and then they don't hear it for some days and they miss it. That happens so many times. They miss it. Where were you? Where were you? In New York, you still get that probably. People, because the kirtans used to go out in New York every day, every day. And then, and people would make fun and they'd laugh. And then it stops. The devotees don't go out for some reason or another. And the people say, where have you been? We miss you. Prasadam. These items, although we tend to take it all for granted, or the deities. The deities are shockingly powerful. Gaudiya, Krishna, Balaram, Radha, Swami, Sundar, they're shockingly powerful. Vrindavan, Prabhupada says in the Krishna book, that even if a non-devotee comes to Vrindavan, he will experience separation from Krishna. Quite astounding. This is the potency of these items. So one has, this is what a devotee tries to do, always become influenced by the transcendental potency of Krishna. Always remain under the shelter and influence of these items, these transcendental items. And if we can somehow do this, we are very fortunate, and we will not be in this world. Even though we will appear to be in this world. Because we're tiny by nature and we have to be influenced. So let us be influenced by the spiritual energy instead of the material energy, which is very dangerous. And sometimes we tend to forget how powerful the influence of Krishna's Maya Shakti is. And we flirt with Maya. And if we flirt with Maya, we will get caught by Maya. We forget. We want to be devotees, but we can play a little bit with Maya. Very dangerous, very dangerous. O Lord, your transcendental name and form are not ascertained by those who merely speculate on the path of imagination. Your name, form, and attributes can be ascertained only through devotional service. So here's the point. They're saying that here you are, O Lord, within the womb of Devaki, and it's very difficult to perceive this, that who you are, because of the covering of Maya. Only through devotional service, only through bhakti. Only through devotion, only through love, when one has love, Krishna consents to reveal his nature, his actual nature to his devotee more and more and more. So otherwise Krishna is inconceivable practically, actually speaking. 37. Even while engaged in various activities, devotees whose minds are completely absorbed at your lotus feet and who constantly hear, chant, and contemplate and cause others to remember your transcendental names and forms are always on the transcendental platform, and thus they can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the process of understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. O Lord, we are fortunate because the heavy burden of the demons upon this earth is immediately removed by your appearance. Indeed, we are certainly fortunate. This is why they're speaking from the point of view of the demigods again. Because they had prayed, Brahma and the other demigods had prayed for Krishna to come because of the great burden of demons within the world. And it was causing such a miserable condition for the proper administration of the universe. So they were praying, please come, O Lord, and he's come. And they were thrilled because now the footprints of the demons that have been marked, marring the earth, will be replaced by the footprints of Krishna. And that is filling them with happiness. We shall be able to see upon the earth and in the heavenly planets the marks of the lotus, the kancha, the club and disc that adorn your lotus feet. O Supreme Lord, you are not an ordinary living entity appearing in this material world as a result of fruit of activities. Therefore, your appearance or birth in this world has no other cause than your pleasure potency. Sambhavam yatma maya. You've come by your own mercy or by your own maya, by your own internal energy. This is what causes the independent Lord to come to this world. No one can make him come. Just like we are born in the particular body or situation that we're born in. Not by our own desire, but due to the potency of Krishna placing us in this situation according to really more his desire in one sense than our karma even. Because we have unlimited karma and he chooses a certain amount of karma to give us in this life. And that karma places us in a particular situation. But Krishna is not forced. Everything he does, including his birth, is simply impelled by his own desire. O Supreme Lord, you're not an ordinary living entity who appears in this material world as a result of fruitive activities. Therefore, your appearance or birth in this world has no other cause than your pleasure potency. You're enjoying with your energies. Similarly, the living entities who are part of you have no cause for miseries like birth, death, old age, and old age, except when these living entities are conducted by your external energy. O Supreme Controller, your Lordship previously accepted incarnations as a fish, a horse, a tortoise, a Sringadev, a boar, a swan, Lord Ramachandra, Parsaram, and among the demigods, Vamanadev. Why? To protect the entire world by your mercy. Now please protect us again by your mercy, by diminishing the disturbances in this world. The demigods are speaking. O Krishna, O best of the Yadus, we respectfully offer our obeisances unto you. Please do this, O Lord. We've prayed for you to come, and now you are here. Please protect us. Please place your lotus footprints on this earth and grace the earth with the marks of the kansa, the disc, the lotus, and the club. And we move in that way the footprints of the demons that are overburdening the earth. They are praying to the Lord who is right there before them. And they know he is the Lord. They know he's transcendental. They know he has unlimited potency. And then they turn to Mother Devaki in text 41. O Mother Devaki, by your good fortune and ours, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, with all his plenary portions, and notice in this verse, Prabhupada points it out in his purport, this para pumam amsena, the Supreme Person. So Prabhupada notes amsena with all his potencies. That this is, again, like Krishna's tu bhagavan sayam, referring to Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. O Mother Devaki, by your good fortune and ours, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, with all his plenary portions, such as Baladev, is now within your womb. Because Krishna includes all the incarnations, they are all within him. They are all, so to speak, merged within the form of Krishna. All the incarnations, because Krishna is the total. Just like when the king is at home in his palace with his family. He's private, he's playing with his family, so that aspect of his nature is there. Plus he's the king still. And plus he has all the potency of the government. But when he's sitting on the throne as the king, he doesn't have the capacity, he doesn't have within him, he has to be in a particular mood, he doesn't have within him, in one sense, that enjoying tendency that he displays in his palace. But it is that supreme position, the most intimate position that possesses all the rest, both the governmental power and the just like the king when he's in his palace, if there's a problem, he can immediately order the armies to do this, this, and this. But when he's sitting on the throne, he can't play with his family. It doesn't work. He has to do that behind closed doors. So the most intimate aspect of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is actually the most powerful aspect and contains all the other aspects. So the demigods have said to Devaki, don't worry about Kamsa, because Kamsa was threatening to kill Krishna and her. Don't worry, because Krishna is within your womb. You have nothing to fear. Kamsa will be killed by him. And then the final verse in this chapter. After thus offering prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, the transcendence, all the demigods with Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva before them returned to their homes in the heavenly planets. Raise your hand if you'd like to go to the heavenly planets. Come on, be honest. The weather is better. So many nice things there. No troubles with your knees and your liver and your eyesight. We don't want to really go there because there's problems there as well. So we have to make our desire to serve and love Krishna so burn so brightly in our heart that the dissatisfactions in our heart that cause us to want material solutions to what is essentially a spiritual problem, that we have no love for Krishna. But that tendency, which is so strong, which slows down our going back home, back to Godhead, to be with Krishna, that they will all be removed, burnt to ashes. So that's this chapter, and that's what we'll read. We'll complete that today. Any questions or comments? And in the second part of the class, I'll read some of the purports and parts of some of the purports. Any questions or comments?
A few words. The author said that because of fruit defectivities.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
In a few words, it was said that because you appear in this world because of fruit defectivities. And I don't understand.
Krishna appears because of fruitive activities? Probably that's not what the verse said. Which verse? Which verse? Just wait.
It's not exactly said that, man. Appearing in this world as a result of fruitive activities.
But this is 39? Please listen. It's simple and clear. But because you don't have a book in front of you, it's hard to sometimes get the exact meaning. Because I was speaking fast also, perhaps. O Supreme Lord, you are not an ordinary living entity appearing in this material world as a result of fruitive activities. Now, that's more sense, yeah? They're not. Therefore, your appearance or birth in this world has no other cause than your pleasure potency that you want to enjoy. You're not being forced by your fruitive activities as we are forced by our fruitive activities. Similarly, the living entities who are part of you have no cause for miseries like birth, death, old age, except when these living entities are conducted by your external energy, which places them under the control of their karma and therefore forced. Clear now, yes? You just
You know, but an ordinary living entity appears as a result of fruitive activities.
But you are not an ordinary living entity appearing.
The ordinary living entity appears because of fruitive activities.
Yes, takes birth, in other words.
Yeah, if he appeared.
Who is the he?
The ordinary living entity, when he appeared. He appears as a result of fruitive activities. But where did he do the fruitive activity that he has appeared? Because he's already here.
Birth after birth after birth after birth after birth after birth. Look around. Well, each of us are in different bodies, have different faces, different clothes, different characteristics, different voices. This is all due to our fruitive activities. It's not talking about how did the living entity fall from the spiritual world. That's not the topic here. Simple point. Not complicated. Any other questions or comments?
What is disease in this?
Excuse me?
The word disease is okay.
It wasn't excluded from your mind when you read it, so no, it's no deep meaning. You can see if it's in the Sanskrit. Karanam vinodam. And also it's interesting that in the verse he is called Abhay Asray, the fearless shelter of all. So if we take shelter of him, we actually become fearless, because he is beyond fear, because he's the supreme controller. But the real question is, how can we increase our devotion? Because only, as Prabhupada will say in a purport, he'll quote Premanjana Charita Bhakti Valochanena, that when one's eyes are full of devotion, then Krishna reveals himself more. So do you have the experience that sometimes you see the deities and your mind is somewhere else completely, and you don't even see the deities? Do you have that experience? And then other times when the heart is soft and there's a more devotional feeling in the heart, you can look at the deities and just look at them for hours and hours and just see how beautiful they are, and just and so many wonderful thoughts come. Do you have that experience too? To some degree, sometimes. So it doesn't exactly depend on the deities, but it depends on our consciousness. So when our consciousness is full of love, then Krishna reveals himself more and more fully. And sometimes by his causeless mercy, he reveals himself more fully, even when our heart is not full of love, and it's shocking. We become shocked at the beauty of the deities, or some special sweetness of Vrindavan, or something. So it depends very much on our consciousness. So then your question is, it's not, if we take it not as a faithless question, but a faithful question, how could I increase my love of Krishna and cause him to reveal more of his beauty to me? So I have a suggestion for that. Today you should go in front of Krishna Balaram and somehow push all the crowds away and just put your elbows, take your position, secure, put your elbows on the railing, and don't move, no matter who's there. And just sit there for a long time. And I want you to ask Lord Balaram that question. How can I see how beautiful you are? I have such material eyes. If you don't help me, how will I do it? And then start complaining. That's my suggestion to you. Will you do it? Do you have time to do that today? How much time do you have?
I want time.
Huh? But I want a commitment of time. An hour in front of Krishna Balaram. Like this too. no one else can come at that time in that spot. Okay? But, okay. If not an hour, then at least 48 or 50 minutes. But not less. Any other questions? Yes.
It was explained in the division in verse 30.
Okay, just wait, just let me get there. Text 30. Excuse me? Text 33. O Madhava, Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord of the Goddess of Fortune. If devotees completely in love with you sometimes fall from the path of devotion, they do not fall like non-devotees, for you still protect them. Thus they fearlessly traverse the heads of their opponents and continue to progress in devotional service. Yes.
Maybe it's an expression in English, completely in love with you, because it seems that someone who is completely in love with the Lord would have no reason to fall down except offenses, and then if he commits offenses, then the Lord will not protect you.
I couldn't hear the last sentence. Unless, so you said that if you completely love Krishna, then you can't fall down. And then, unless he commits offenses, and then what was the...
If he offends the devotees, then the Lord will not protect him.
The Lord
will not protect him. I mean, he will protect him when, maybe in some different way, but he doesn't like when someone offends his devotees. But I mean, how would you, why would you fall down? What would be the reason? If you're completely involved with Krishna, meaning you don't have attachment to material things, you are entranced with his beauty, with his pastimes, with his rivers, and that's all you live for. So then, how?
I think that one answer you gave is that one could commit offenses. One can commit offenses, so one should be careful. Another answer would be that this is a devotee who completely loves Krishna, he won't fall down. But even if he did fall down, he won't fall down. But even if he did fall down, Krishna will take care of him. So that gives strength and faith and encouragement to us who are not on that platform too. That no matter what position you're in, if you have trouble, Krishna will not forget you. And a third reason that one could fall down is Mayavad philosophy. Because that's in Chaitanya Charitamrita, I believe it says that even a Mahabhagavata can fall down by hearing Mayavad philosophy, studying the Sharirak Bhasya of Shankaracharya. So I think all three are reasonable explanations. One doesn't expect, certainly, someone who's completely in love with Krishna to fall down. But even if such an impossible thing happened, due to Krishna would take care of them. And in the Sanskrit, it's tavaka, means yours, the followers of devotional path. And so Prabhupada put that in the translation. Okay, why don't we stop here? It's 12, so 12:30, promptly, and we'll begin again. And Krishna willing, and we'll read some of Prabhupada's purports. But see if you can get a feel for what the demigods are saying and why they're saying it. They're showing how only by devotion one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is doing something so astonishing, in fact, appearing within the womb of Devaki and is completely all-powerful, transcendental, embryonic form, but with no loss of potency. astonishing. Okay. Thank you, Hare Krishna.